This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Byrgeist, Boogie Beasts and Black Shook, black dogs in British folklore.
I love all of those words. They're great.
I quite like Boogie Beast.
Yeah, I like that one as well. It almost sounds like a dance, you know, that you'd get in the late 80s.
Boogie Beast.
It's like a thing you'd use to describe someone on the dance floor.
Yes.
So yeah, this week we're looking at those big black dogs that we get across British folklore, and in particular we're gonna be looking at some of the books that they appear in, including I Am the Silence.
Yeah.
which I'm gonna make the main focus of today's episode, because I have been dying to talk about this book since I read it. Gosh, was it
a year ago now?
It was a year ago now. Gosh. Yeah. I'm rereading it now, so
you're rereading it?
Of course I'm rereading it.
Would you not like an up-to-date copy?
Yeah, I'd love an up-to-date copy. You sent me an up-to-date copy right now. I'll reread the up-to-date copy.
I'll do that then. Sorry, I didn't realise you were rereading it.
Of course I'm rereading it. Rereading it in preparation for the release. So, first of all, it's got to be asked, what put you on the trail of the big black dog, Jules?
Do you mean for the book?
I mean, just in general, what was the first version of the big black dog myth that you ever heard of?
It was the Byrgeist, probably, which appears in a book called The Whitby Witches by Robin Jarvis. And it also appeared in a book that I read about the same time, which was The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, except it wasn't the Byrgeist in the second book. It was actually Cuanon, or Cusi.
Yeah.
Which is the Celtic Hound of Hell.
Yeah. And can you sort of describe a little bit more detail what the difference is and sort of what the Byrgeist is?
I should be able to, really, shouldn't I? But, the Byrgeist is a big black hound, as large as a calf, with fiery red eyes, and it is the harbinger of doom and a malevolent spirit. And it is said to haunt byways of York and preys on lone travellers. And obviously Bram Stoker borrowed the local legend when he wrote Dracula, because he has the ship that Dracula docks into Whitby, the Demeter. He has Dracula transform into a giant black hound and leap ashore.
Yeah.
He was actually borrowing a local legend for that. And there's lots and lots of different... In fact, I mean, I knew of a couple when I started writing I Am the Silence, because I've sort of woven it in there. But I was surprised at how many there were, how many different types of black dog legends there were in the British Isles.
Yeah.
Absolutely loads of them.
Yeah, no, there really are. But I mean, I'm pretty sure it's also where there are moors, there are big black dogs or big black cats.
Yeah.
Where there's a moor, there's a monster. That should be a saying.
There's another northern one, it's an East Anglia. One that's Black Shuck, and that's probably the most malevolent one.
Yeah,
that was the one that actively there's stories of it actively killing people or looking on them and striking them dead. Men, not women, because it's a lady's dog for some reason.
Yeah, no, Black Shuck was the first one I ever came across, and I think actually the first time I heard of Black Shuck wasn't actually in a book. It was a song.
Yeah.
And it was the darkness, Black Shuck.
That's where I first heard Black Shuck as well. Shuck actually comes from skooka, which is this Anglo-Saxon word meaning demon.
There you go, then.
The Black skooka.
Yeah, that was the first time I'd heard of it, and I sort of looked a little bit more into it, because I was listening to the song, and, you know, those guys are crazy anyway, so I was like, what on earth is this song about? So I looked into it, and it was fascinating. And then I realised, of course, that I had actually heard different versions of it in The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yeah, that's a Yell Hound.
But the descriptions are usually quite similar. The burning eyes, the kind of the fiery sort of saliva.
That was the thing that I found so strange. I mean, I turned up dozens of these different legends, all with different names, and almost all of them had pretty much the same, you know, as you say, as big as a calf, black, either shaggy or very dense dark fur, and a howl that, you know, could either strike you dumb with terror and paralyze you, or sort of tore through you, made you lose your reason, and you know, feet as big as dinner plates and that sort of thing, this hugeness. And it just sort of appeared out of nowhere. And the other thing was some electrical storms. They quite often had they quite often accompanied electrical storms and things,
of course,
as well. Strangely enough. But it was really I suppose it's not so strange that it's within the British Isles sort of area that we have very similar legends. But it was strange that I don't know of any other ghost stories, I don't think, where you have so many of these points that are point for point the same across all the different stories.
Yeah, it's true. The big black dog phenomena is very, very consistent throughout. And I mean, it isn't just across the British Isles. You get big black dogs in lots of other places as well. And I wonder what it is. Are we just afraid of the colour black? Is that it? Are we just freaked out by it?
I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, the Biergeist, in all fairness, can actually appear as a mule or a horse as well. So a large dark horse or mule with fiery eyes, but more commonly seen and spotted as a large black dog.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes it's a case of, well, no, these are almost demonic entities, and a dog seems to be the shape that it takes most often. And it's all tangled up with Celtic mythology as well. Like I mentioned Cusi, which if you saw it written down, you'd say Cusith, because that's what it looks like, but it's actually Cusi. It's a Scottish hound, the size of a bull, built like a wolf with shaggy fur and a coiled tail. Cusi basically is like a canine grim reaper, as in it will bear away the soul. It's a bit like the Bean Shay as well.
Yeah.
In the sense that it will warn you, you'll hear it crying. And if you haven't found safety by the time you heard the third cry, then that's it. You're not making it off the moors. You're not making it out of the highlands that night.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's as much to do with sense, which is like, if you hear something howling while you're out on the moors, get off the moors. I mean, just relative common sense, because, you know, there's lots of stuff that probably wants to eat you. Also, you know, it's getting dark and you should probably not be on the moors at that time anyway. Of course, I mean, one of the most famous examples of the big black dog being used as an omen of death is in Harry Potter in the third book.
Yeah. And both the Grim and Padfoot are also, you know, localised names for the Biergeist.
Exactly. And I mean, of course, his name is Sirius as well, which is, you know, the whole, the dog star. I mean, yeah.
Sirius Black, even.
Yeah, his name was Sirius Black. I mean, J.K. Rowling wasn't exactly, you know, subtle with it. I mean, you've got Lupin, Remus Lupin, Werewolf McWerewolf turned out to be a werewolf. I mean, who'd have thunk it? I'm almost certain that's why he got bitten, because whatever the guy, you know, there's that fan theory, which is just the werewolf who bit Lupin just went, well, I had to bite him. His name was Werewolf McWerewolf. I couldn't not.
A bit like all those Dickensian characters that become their names.
Yeah, exactly. I'm all for names having meaning, but, you know, J.K. Rowling was not playing around. But yeah, so he's Sirius Black. And then even his nickname, you know, it's Padfoot. And he looks like a big, shaggy black dog, which is huge and, you know, terrifies people. And that was an interesting way of doing the myth, because obviously in the end, he's not that evil thing. And we don't very often get stories where the big black dog turns out not to be the, you know, the thing that's dangerous. I mean, even in The Hound of the Baskervilles, the dog is sort of, it's debunked, the dog is not actually demonic, but it's still a dangerous hound, you know.
It is dangerous, but I mean, the reason it's dangerous is because it's been mistreated.
Yeah, no, I mean, don't get me wrong, the fact of the matter is that the way it's, you know, we looking onto it, saying, no, this is a creature which has been horrifically abused. It's been made to do what it's done. You know, it's at the whims of a very cruel master. But at the end of the day, the dog still gets shot. The dog does not turn out to be friendly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we don't get many examples where actually the dog is not evil or is not dangerous in some way to people.
Yeah.
So yeah, but it was interesting that that's what they did in Harry Potter. And I don't know about the examples that you've given of other books with black dogs in them.
Yeah, I mean, in The Whitby Witches, the black dog in that turns out to be evil, but it's not evil because it's a black dog, because the black dog actually turns out to be a shape-shifting high witch.
Oh, fair enough.
And then in the Whitby Child, which is the third book in the series, there's an entire pack of them, and they are terrifying. They are genuinely very, very frightening, because it's that the whole idea is that they've been given the ability to allow the beast within out.
Yeah.
And they're not like werewolves. They still have consciousness. It's just that, you know, all the things that keep you humane and keep you behaving as a human being mm-hmm. are sort of just shoved to one side, and you're all about the kill. And humans are actually really, really nasty predators, so...
Yeah, they are.
But in the Weird Stone of Prison Gammon, it's Kuanon who turns up, and, you know, they're basically hounds that warn the children of Danu that they're about to die. And by the third time the hound turns up, you know, one of them's not going to make it home. And that it's not a bad thing, it follows that particular family and warns them that one of them's going to die. So yeah. They're seen as bad, but they're just doing their job, if you like.
Yeah. In fact, in some ways, they're actually helping because, you know, it's pre-warning.
So, yeah, get your affairs in order.
Just to say, you might want to finish that will. Say goodbye. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, they got a lot of bad rep, the harbingers of death, but they're not the ones that are causing death. They're just there kind of like, this is your, you know, 5-minute warning.
There are black dogs who are actually benevolent. As well, there is Gert Dog, which is Somerset Hound.
Of course it would be in Somerset.
And Somerset was you know, for a long time, quarrying country. Mm-hmm. And it used to haunt the sort of quarry-type areas. And it would watch over children who used to play up there. And it would also help lonely and lost travellers to find their way home. And there's a few others like that as well. Hairy Jack in Lincolnshire. Protects travellers and guards unattended children. It, to be fair, I mean, it does seem to be that a lot of these big black dogs, if they are aggressive, they seem to be particularly aggressive towards men. Because women walking alone, widows and unmarried women, quite often there's all sorts of stories where a woman who's been frightened of walking home alone mm-hmm. has reported a huge black dog walking with her as a guardian until she got to her front door.
See, that is quite interesting. That's a very interesting, and it'd be interesting to see where the origin of that might be, because you know dogs have often been considered not the servants is the wrong word, but you know man's best friend, and it's interesting that these personifications of dogs are the guardians of women, and in a particular female virtue, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it runs back to times when you'd have, you know, the women would be left running the farms, and a lot of these places were very, very rural, so you were out in the middle of nowhere, and if you were a woman left running your husband's farm or whatever while he and your sons were sent off to war, then you were pretty much by yourself, so it made sense to have a big mastiff-like dog who would bait you and nobody else.
Yeah, it did make total sense. I mean, the thing is that women were in charge of the home for a very, very long time, and that didn't just mean being at home and doing the cooking. It meant being in charge of the affairs of the house. So, yeah, it made total sense to have a dog who would be the guard, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it probably does run from that. But it is interesting, of course, because, you know, going back to Black Shuck, we get a lot of stories of these big black demonic dogs attacking priests and things along those lines. But yeah, they never attack women. In fact, the only time I've heard of the big black dog myth attacking a woman is actually in a song by Cadia, which actually featured in my short Kestrel short story in Stalking Leviathan. The story is based on the beast of Bodmin Moor. And at the end, we get the song by Cadia called The Beast of Bodmin Moor, which starts off with a young woman who goes out across the moor to go and meet with her lover, and she's attacked by the beast and is never seen again. And I think that's the only time I've ever heard of a woman being attacked by a big black dog.
That's a slight departure, because certainly in Northern myths, and I did obviously do quite a bit of research.
Yeah.
It does seem to be that, you know, they might predict a woman's death, but, you know, they don't tend to see them off themselves. But
No. But yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon, and it is our relationships with canines, you know, humans' relationship with canines is interesting. Because as I said, we get the black dog myth, or we get, you know, the dog spirit myth in most cultures. And it's an interesting phenomenon of how we treat them, basically.
Yeah.
And both our fear and our expectation of them.
Yeah, going back to what you were saying about me including black dogs.
Yeah.
In I Am Silence. Initially, I intended to... There's a lot of sightings of black cats in Dorset.
Yeah.
And I intended it to be a black cat. And I did a bit more research and found all these like amazing ghost stories, which is where that went. And that sort of wove together with a song called Black Eyed Dog by Nick Drake. And I realised that actually this was quite reflective of the main character's state of mind. The song Black Eyed Dog is actually about depression, which is something Nick Drake suffered from. And mm-hmm. he either deliberately or accidentally killed himself when he was 26 by taking an overdose of sleeping tablets. So a lot of people think, you know, Black Eyed Dog was really his last sort of, I'm trying to come out of this, but I can't get anywhere. The anxiety and the depression are killing me.
Yeah.
And I mean, whether you think it was an accident or not, it's entirely personal. Nobody really knows, I don't think. It's just opinion. And it's very sad. But I think there's another level to that song.
Yeah.
Which is something that Emlyn actually discusses in the course of the book. But I found it interesting that it was like an archetype to have so many, if you like, entities appearing as huge black dogs, almost as if the viewer was seeing something of themselves reflected on the outside.
Yeah. And going into that, let's go into that a little bit deeper. It's very interesting, of course, that actually the black dog often reflects the mood that the protagonist is in. Again, we look at Harry Potter. Harry felt like he was in danger and then was being sort of stalked, apparently, by this big black dog that he kept seeing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so we look at Emmeline, and there's another element of the big black dog, which is the, you know, we look at the whole Shuck thing, which is, or rather the whole hellhound thing, which is comeuppance, or rather, you've done something, or you've been given something, and now it is time to pay. Or now you are going to face your punishment. And one thing that Emmeline is, you know, going through is she's feeling a bit guilty about stuff. She's feeling restless. She's feeling depressed. We don't want to spoil too much of what's kind of going on. One aspect is that Emmeline is reconnecting in this book with a friend whom she lost touch with in the first book, and that's Beth. And then this black dog begins to appear, and we're not going to go into how the big black dog appears or what that storyline is. But as you say, it is very reflective of the things that Emmeline is going through and the kind of the dread she feels. You wonder whether, is she feeling dread because of the big black dog, or is she feeling dread and the big black dog is kind of sort of only emphasising that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it, exactly. Because ultimately, if you think about some of the other things that she's facing in that book, the black dog's not actually the most scary, and yet she's fixated on it.
Yeah, she is. She can't get it out of her head. And there are some really horrible things that she is facing in the book. But the black dog is the one she's most afraid of, which makes me feel like she's trying to run away from something, and she's focusing it on the black dog, but it's not actually the black dog that she is trying to run away from. Well, I mean, she's also trying to run away from the black dog, because the black dog is scary, let's not lie. but on an internal level, she's hiding from her feelings and what she's going through and some of the stuff that she doesn't really want to admit to herself, and she is running away. And yeah, I think in some ways the black dog, she kind of uses it as an excuse, or rather she uses it to focus her energy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Gosh, I love this book. Sorry, it's very difficult for me not to just splurge, because I'd love to just go through the entire thing. Okay, let's look at something else. Let's look at the relationship of the black dog and music.
Okay.
So obviously you were a little bit inspired by a song, and the black dog and hellhounds and stuff like that do appear actually in a lot of music. In particular, they appear in a lot of blues and folk, and music is a big component of the second book. Would you agree?
Yes, I would do. I mean, you get a fair bit in the first book, but the second book she's active. She's gone it's set in Dorset because she's gone down to stay in Dorset for the Festival of Music, which happens every year in Milton Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
And it does actually genuinely happen. Yes. Not quite like how I've written it, but it does actually genuinely happen. And it's
a real thing.
It's a real thing. Far less involvement of the dead, as far as I'm aware. But
well, I mean, you don't know.
I don't know. I could be wrong.
Who knows what those crazy kids get up to these days?
Oh, well, yeah. One of those crazy kids would be my father, but...
Who knows what your father gets up to these days?
Be very surprised if it was... Yeah, moving on. So music is a big part of it. She's now back doing something in a fairly professional arena with it.
Yeah.
And with all the trials and rubbings of personality that sort of involves. Because people who are very, very intense, particularly about artistic endeavours, can be quite socially inept, I want to say.
Careful, hey, you be careful there. I will fight you.
I'm thinking of this one, actually scientists as well. I'm thinking, you know, anybody who is that dedicated to something, to almost the exclusion of all else, can sometimes forget that other people think and feel and are people.
Yeah. Speaking of which, let's talk about a character who's introduced into this series. We have a character who's a bit of a dark horse himself.
Yeah.
And that is Lucas. Now, just for some, how shall I put it, context. I have been doing battle with Jules' editor because he really likes Lucas. And I have my, shall we say, reservations about him and his role. And if anyone wants to witness what these battles look like, I mean, all you have to do is go onto my Twitter and type hashtag Team Kieran or hashtag Team Lucas, and you will find the very long conversation. Beware of spoilers. Now, despite what I've been saying on Twitter, and despite, you know, what I've been throwing around, the slander that I've been throwing around, Lucas is not a character that I detest. He's a very interesting character. And he, in some ways, is almost a bit, sort of, is another aspect of that kind of that black dog in a lot of ways, in that he is mysterious, he's kind of cold, he's a little bit indifferent. And yeah, was that intentional?
What, to tie him up with Black Dog as well?
Or
to
The psychology of it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, he's not... It's difficult to say, but he tries to help without helping. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. There's this outsideness about him, which is that he's there, but he's not there. And he is a very interesting character. He's a very intense character. And to be honest, for a while, this is not really a spoiler, you know, for a while I was reading it and I'm like, is he the black dog himself? Because there was that energy about him. And, you know, he is tied into it in his own way. And you know, I'm again, no spoilers.
Well, you never see them together, do you?
Yeah, I'm not saying he's the black dog. I'm just saying I never saw them in the same room together. So... They could all be the black dog. Emlyn could be the black dog. Who knows? She kind of is in some ways. They kind of all are. And I think you come away from the book wondering actually what the supernatural is and where the line is drawn, and yeah, what makes a person, and what makes a magical creature a magical creature. So it is interesting, the inclusion of this character at the same time as the inclusion of this newer aspect of the supernatural. Because up until this point, you know, Emmeline has been facing ghosts, and that's pretty standard. I mean, standard, you know.
Standard for her.
Typical Tuesday afternoon is just, I'm just going to have lunch and then go fight the dead. So, you know, that's a pretty typical thing for Emmeline to be dealing with. And it's also funny because we've had, you know, the beginning of book two is a total turnaround, where beginning of book one, Emmeline is face of the dead, and it's just pretty much the first section of the book is just her going, nope, 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 not dealing with this.
Yep.
And her literally sidestepping the dead at every possible, you know, opportunity, to the point where she's literally sidestepping it. I mean, she's going down past that cold spot and she just goes around it. Whereas the beginning of book two has her actively looking for something.
Yes.
She's searching for the dead. And again, this is right at the beginning, so I wouldn't consider it to be a spoiler.
Well, that's... I mean, don't worry too much, because I had the first five chapters up as a sample on my website.
Oh, there we go. So, you know, she's actively looking for the dead, and she, you know, she's had this total turnaround. And then she faces something entirely new. And she's kind of, again, thrown out of her depth, where, you know, she thought she knew where she was. And then suddenly there's this creature of the kind she's never faced before. And it's not just the creature. There are people and there are things happening that throw her way out of her depth. And in a very typical Emmeline way, what does she do when she's faced with all of these things? She doesn't ask for help, so thanks for that, Emmeline.
She is probably slightly better than she was in book one at not isolating herself, but she still has real trouble with that asking for help thing.
Yeah, which again...
She does have a reason at the beginning of book two, though. She's feeling betrayed by certain things.
By certain things? Mm-hmm, I see. Yes, they're probably calling it things.
Yes, well, the person she might have gone to for help, or most likely might have gone to for help, as in, you know, Aunt Mary, has done something that she can't quite forgive her for, so.
And yeah, she's feeling disconnected from certain people who shall not be named. Kieran. Sorry. The first five chapters were up, it's fine. So again, we have that. She's depressed. Oh, she was depressed in the first book, but she's depressed in a way in the second book, which again is the big black dog in the room.
I think in a way it's more that she regained a lot of this confidence and a lot of this, you know, physical dexterity, and her disfluency had decreased enough that she felt she could speak now if she was careful. Whereas that was something that was really taken away from her in the first book.
Yeah.
And she still has all those disadvantages, but she's learned to work around them. So her confidence is a lot higher, but she's a bit frustrated because of various circumstances. And then she really gets dealt a blow to the confidence. She's sort of a bit mortified. She realises that perhaps she's charged in with her heart a bit too firmly on her sleeve. And of course, it makes it a target for everyone if that's where you wear it. So she's feeling quite wounded. I suppose, more than depressed, but yeah.
Yeah. I think there's another aspect as well, which is that she's separated from, you know, up until this point, at the end of the first book, you see her united with her sisters. You see her united with, you know, things are getting better. She's kind of built this fortress around herself. Her home, which was a place of horror, is now a bit of a sanctuary.
Yes.
She's established herself. She's established her ties. And then in the second book, her sister, one sister is at university, the other sister's in Switzerland.
Yep.
And she is back with this estranged friend who is not the person she remembers.
No, and that's the thing, I think, that's the real tipping point. Because it's not a case of they just, you know, you have friends and you can fall out of touch with them, and yet you meet them on the street one day and it's like no time's gone past at all.
Yeah.
And then you have other friends where you have to work a little bit harder. And then friends you meet up with and they're like, oh my God, you're a completely different person.
Yeah.
And it's that horrible feeling of dislocation.
Yeah. Which she experiences in droves, because Beth is not the person she left off. And again, that there's that guilt, because Emmeline was the one who secluded herself. And yeah. Beth, you know, kept giving openings, and finally Emmeline sort of takes one. But in some ways, it's too late.
Yeah, and that's something I think she's probably going to have to live with, because possibly Beth wouldn't have become the person she does in the second book if she'd still been in touch with Beth. Mind you, how much blame can you apportion to somebody? So we all have to be like responsible for our own actions. I don't know, but you know, if I was Emmeline, I would be thinking, you know, how much of that was my fault?
Yeah. And how much of it is because Beth is just a terrible, terrible friend?
She's not that terrible.
I think I really appreciated it, because I've definitely had friends, you know, I've got friends who I won't see for months, and then we just see each other, and you know, it's as you say, you click, and no time has changed at all. And then there have been friends who you fall out of touch with, and then you meet up with them again, and it's just. You suddenly realise that you're both two entirely different people, and the chemistry that was there before is just gone.
Yeah.
And when you're suddenly in a position where you are kind of at their disposal of that, you know, she's staying with Beth in a place which was once her home, but is now kind of unfamiliar in some respects. She's never been able to, you know, she doesn't have anywhere else to go. She has nowhere else to run to. It's very... She's put in a very vulnerable position. It's a very lonely position. It's even lonelier when you think you're with someone you know, and then you don't know them at all.
Yeah, particularly when it's a case of there's just enough familiarity to make you lower your guard, and then every time you do, something just sort of snaps back, and you think, well, okay, I don't know you, because you'd never have said that before.
Yeah.
That would never have mattered to you. It doesn't matter to me. Are we on the same page at all? And it is... I'm sure it happens with all friendships, and it can happen, certainly as a teenage girl, it can happen from one week to the next, it seems, with some friends.
Yeah,
you don't have to fall out of touch with them, just suddenly one day it's like, okay, you're on a completely different track to me now, what happened?
Yeah, where has it gone? Yeah, but there's a real psychology to the book, which is very much reflected in its supernatural happenings, and the two are very parallel to one another. Keeps you on your toes.
I hope so.
No, it does. My family failed to get me to do anything for like several days because I was just busy reading. Like, it's time to go skiing now. It's time to have lunch. And just no, you know what? You just go ahead. I need to finish this chapter.
Actually, one of my ARC readers was saying, yeah, I'm starting it today. And then there was a status update saying, oh my God, I'm like 35%. What are you doing? And then later it was like, I finished it. I'm like, you finished it in 24 hours?
She was not happy with you.
What at all? I honestly don't know.
I think most of her status updates were just, what? What are you doing? No. I believe was, I can quote.
I will just go back to Lucas briefly. I, because mm-hmm. somebody asked me a question, I think based off of the Twitter chat I had with Matt, and saying, you know, have you done a love triangle? And if so, why have you gone in a slightly more typical young adult trope direction? And I actually don't think I have done one.
No.
I think it's more a case of this is an awkward situation you can find yourself in.
Yeah, and it's less of a, oh gosh, who do I choose kind of scenario. It's actually, I feel, it's more something that a lot of girls actually face, which is friends kind of, the whole friend zone thing. I hate that. That really awkward position where you just want to be friends with someone, but they fall in love with you and you're just a bit sort of, please, can we just be friends?
Yeah, and it is really difficult, and you don't necessarily know at the time that the best thing you can do, if you want to be really honest, quite often, if somebody can't accept that particular boundary, is to say, I'm sorry, we can't be friends then. And it's a really difficult thing to do. The thing I don't like about love triangles in young adult fiction in general is the fact that it usually means that one person gets to choose who they want to be with, while at the same time enjoying this sort of succulent little sponge bath for the soul,
yeah,
by knowing that somebody else is in pain over them. And I find that quite damaging, and that's something I do not want to happen. So it's awkward, but it was naturally going to fall out the way it has done that way.
Well, I mean, the thing about Emmeline is that I'm just going to go and say it. She's a bit heartbroken at the beginning of the second book.
Yeah.
But she's still very much in love, and she remains in love, I think, to be honest.
Yeah. Not that she would ever use those words herself.
No, she wouldn't, but then, you know, I'm taking liberties. That's another thing about the black dog myth. There's two versions. Either the black dog is always alone, or there's the sort of the pack, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of examples where you get the pack.
Do you mean in current literature or
in
folklore?
In folklore and in current.
I mean, in folklore, they turn up with things like QAnon, which is always part of a pack.
Mm-hmm.
The Gabriel Hounds.
I mean, the Wild Hunt, I guess that's QAnon, isn't it, as well?
Yeah. They always show up in a pack there. The lone black dogs tend to be the ones that are really dangerous.
Yeah.
Or, conversely, the ones that are really benevolent. Because in a pack, they are hunting.
Yeah.
Whereas alone, they just seem to be sort of haunting.
And that's rather telling for the story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you have the whole... Emmeline is focused on the lone creature rather than the pack.
Yeah.
And it's the pack she probably needs to be worried about. Well, I mean, I don't know, to be honest. She should be... You know, if I was Emmeline, I would have just left Dorset very, very quickly.
Trouble is, she sort of cottons on to think, maybe I'll do that when it's a bit too late.
Yeah. You know what? I'm just going to go. That's another thing, which is that why is it that whenever she's in these situations, modern technology just fails her?
Well, she failed modern technology in the first book. She just did not charge her mobile phone.
Yeah, and now I really like the third book for her to be like, just finally to conquer it and just learn to Google stuff. And accept callers and stuff like that.
To be fair, she Googles the black dogs.
She does.
With a bit of help from Amy.
With a little bit of help from Amy.
Who, of course, is like curious about all those sort of things, so naturally keeps cryptozoology files because she's just that much of a nerd. Actually, I mean, I think that's quite believable for Amy, but...
No, I think that's very in character.
I mean, since Amy's away at a physics camp...
Doing God knows what, I've got to read that short story as well. Up to no good.
I think you'll like that one, actually.
I'm looking forward to it. There is, of course, a companion piece. I say a companion piece. The short story that goes alongside... Well, I mean, all of the stories kind of happen at the same time, because you've got Grace's Choice.
No,
Amazing Grace, rather.
That happens sort of the winter before.
And then you've got Amy's
Academicals, which is happening while she's in Dorset.
Yeah, while Emmeline's in Dorset.
Yep.
And Amy's in Switzerland, doing the whole Frankenstein thing. And then you have Kieran's Choice, which happens just before.
Yeah.
And sort of during.
Yeah, it sort of overlaps a little bit.
Yeah. I tell you what, it made a difference. It's going to make a difference rereading the I Am the Silence now with more context.
Yeah. I have to say, that was really weird, because obviously I wrote I Am the Silence, and then I wrote, well, I sort of know what he's doing, and I wrote Kieran's Chance, and it was like, okay, this is kind of painful. And I went back to do the editing on I Am the Silence, and it was like, oh, this really hurts.
Now, here's a question. Has Matt read Kieran's Chance?
I don't think so, but he's not a fan of the character. I don't think he'd enjoy it.
Well, like, maybe it'll make him sort of change his mind.
Good luck.
I don't know why he doesn't like him. Kieran is amazing.
I think because he's just... Okay, what I was told was because he's so effortlessly handsome and charming, etc. And it's like, oh, I suppose he is.
Nothing wrong with that. That's the point. He's not. Sorry, this is becoming about Kieran. I could talk a lot about Kieran. He's one of my favourite characters. But then if we compare Lucas to the black dog, which he is in some ways, this sort of solitary, slightly cold, slightly mysterious figure, who has a connection with death, and is very unearthly in his ways. And you compare him with Kieran, who is the total opposite. Kieran is very earthbound, very salt of the earth, warm, light, compassion, you know what I mean?
Yeah, open, friendly,
openness,
funny.
Friendly, yeah, funny. Approachable, in a way that Lucas isn't. And the dynamic between the two of them is interesting. I will actually be interested to see more interaction between them.
Between Kieran and Lucas?
Between Kieran and Lucas, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing them sort of come to a begrudging, it will be begrudging, kind of truce. I think the other thing I like is that very often in the whole love triangle thing, and again, yours is not a love triangle, but the sort of the protagonist will go for the deep brooding one instead. And I don't think for once, you know, it's represented that actually you don't need to go for someone who kind of makes you feel a bit crappy, to be honest.
No, you don't need to go for someone who makes you feel... I mean, in all fairness, Lucas isn't as bad as he makes himself out to be.
No, he definitely puts on a bit of a front to kind of scare people off.
But yeah, you're right. And it's a case of, oh, well, I'll go for the intense brooding one because that means they must love me more kind of thing. And it's like, no. No, not necessarily. Yeah,
it's not necessarily what you need in a relationship. Or necessarily, and it's also that what do you need in a friendship? And what do you need at certain times of your life? Because it could be argued that actually, in some respects, Emily needed Lucas at that particular time. And it could be argued that Emily needed Lucas at that particular time like she needed a punch in the face. Because he certainly doesn't help. Like, in some ways he helps, in some ways he challenges her and gets her to sort of come out of her shell, and in other ways he really doesn't help very much. You know, she's going through all of this stuff, she's facing these rather horrible things, and then she kind of, where she could go, where she could turn to sort of find warmth and life and love and sort of refind her energy, she has Lucas instead, who's a bit doom and gloom, and he's... He doesn't take anything less than perfection from her. He's very demanding.
I mean, I think he would be exhausting to be with.
Yeah.
Because there would never be downtime.
Yeah.
It would always be this constant striving towards...
Lucas doesn't do downtime.
No, he really doesn't, does he?
It's perfection and nothing less.
But there is obviously a good reason for that because, well, I can't say, but... He is the product of his background.
Yeah, and we, you know, I feel it's only fair to say that within the context of the story, Lucas is instructing Emmeline in music. So we're not saying that he when we say he demands perfection from her, it's not some sort of, no, you must do up your shirt and, you know, and stand properly or anything like that. When we say he demands perfection from her, he demands perfection from her performance and from her musical ability.
It's like, no, if you want to play violin, you're going to do it properly.
Yeah,
or you can find someone else to teach you.
Yeah, and to be fair, he does make her improve leaps and bounds.
Yeah, he does. I don't necessarily, I personally, and I wrote it, I still don't necessarily think his methods were right, but then she probably improved a hell of a lot faster that way.
Yeah, but I think she did it despite him.
Yes, yes.
She's fueled by spite every time.
Sometimes that's what gets you out of bed in the morning, though.
Yeah, it's like, I've got all of this supernatural stuff to sort of contend with, but today I'm going to practice just to spite this guy, because
I mean, in some ways, I think he was good because she wanted someone she could legitimately hate and be angry with.
Yeah, because she couldn't hate Kieran.
Because she does, at the beginning of the book, again, I'm not spoiling anything, when I turn around and say, she says Kieran was a coward, you know. Yeah. And she has got a point there.
It's because she doesn't know that he was a bit of a coward.
I think it was still a bit cowardly what he did. But anyway, I won't go into that. But at the same time, it's more a case of she has a lot of disgust for herself because of, you know, not wanting to be one of those girls that waits around for someone to come back to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. It hurts. I thought that after the first book I couldn't cry anymore, but I was wrong. I could cry. I found a way. You found a way.
I'm going to have my work cut out with me, book three, aren't I?
Oh, come on, Jules. I've already cried listening to sections of book three. What do you mean? Get teary-eyed at every opportunity. Somehow you always manage to hit me where it hurts. Anyway, let's go back to the big black dog, shall we?
Yep, big black dogs.
So what other literature have you read that has involved, you know, big black dogs? Because you do it in quite a unique way.
I'm not sure if I do, but I mean, there are things like The Dark is Rising sequence by Susan Cooper, mm-hmm. which I haven't read for years, in fairness. And things like Dennis Wheatley. That was a bit of an influencer, actually, Dennis Wheatley.
Yeah.
Usually they only turn up as sort of apparitions in any of those. But Dennis Wheatley wrote a series of satanic black magic novels with Duke de Richelieu as the main character.
What a name.
He's great. I love the description of his eyebrows. Anyway. I basically had run out of things to read when I was 13. So my dad handed me this pile of paperbacks and said, there you go. And it was a batch of Dennis Wheatley black magic novels that were written like back in the 1940s and 30s. And it was a really old editions, and I got through those. And I don't think I deliberately drew on anything from there, but some of the feel of it, probably.
Yeah.
They're quite dated now, and some of the things that Dennis Wheatley calmly says and some of the style, and that would be probably quite crusty and not very accessible, but I just lapped them up when I was 13.
Yeah. Have you ever read anything with the sort of black dog that actually kind of disappointed you, or where the reveal of the black dog kind of disappointed you?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, I don't like The Hound of the Baskervilles.
No? Why is that?
I think possibly because it turned out not to be something a bit supernatural, or he didn't leave it open-ended. Yeah. But then I do know that Conan Doyle didn't want to necessarily write it as a Sherlock Holmes story originally, but there was so much demand for Sherlock Holmes that he ended up changing the story.
Yeah.
And I like the way he drew on the folklore around Devon and also around the Welsh border, and people still aren't 100% sure whether he set it in Devon or the Welsh border.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like the idea of this family offending the powers that be and being hunted by a black dog through the generations.
But it's just that he said there was a lack of probability. But he was ready to accept that the supernatural could be a thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, one that probably disappointed me with the reveal was The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Fair enough. I think the Hound of the Baskervilles, one of the main aspects, though, of it is the relationship between the hound and the environment, which, again, you know, we go back to why these places with moors and stuff like that have these demonic figures in them.
Yeah.
And I think there's this great relationship between wide open spaces which get quite foggy and misty, and these terrible huge creatures. And I also think, you know, there's the whole kind of, it was, you know, it was we got chased by what? Oh, we got chased by this huge dog. It was bigger than a cow. Like, are you sure it wasn't just a cow? You could admit that you were chased by cows. I mean, cows are pretty scary as well, let's not lie, you know? People get killed by cows all the time. You know, I think there's probably a relationship between people getting scared by relatively normal farmyard animals and then not quite wanting to admit that that's what it was, and, you know, they kind of imagine something else, or they just say it was something else. And also the idea that there might actually be, you know, big cats of some nature running around on certain moors and in certain areas.
It's interesting talking about the relationship between a creature and, you know, the environment, the earth, if you like.
Yeah.
Is something I did touch on briefly, and that's the four Aerts. which are sort of spirits of nature or demigods in Celtic, Irish or Scottish mythology. Et means direction or compass point or wind, and there were four main ones. In the south it's a white mare, and it's quite noticeable in southern Britain. There's carved white horses on lots of chalk escarpments. The east is a red stag, the west is a grey wolf, and the Et of north, which is, you know, correspondent with the earth and ley lines, is a black dog.
That is very interesting.
So it goes a long way back in our sort of collective memory.
But there is again that the northern wind, you know, the northern association we have with the north, which is cold and dangerous. Sorry, anyone listening from Scotland or above. I don't mean any offence, but like, it's cold up north. It's cold.
Well, because another influencer might well have been when the Danes came over and invaded Britain, and the Nords came over, they brought the mythology of Garm, who was the guardian of hell, which is a great black hound.
Yeah, I mean, the association of hounds and hell, there's a lot of it. You know, you've got in Greek mythology the three-headed hound, who was basically called Spot. Well, it's true. I'm pretty sure it's true. I read it somewhere that I may have been an unreliable source, but Cerberus, I think, means spotted. I'm going to check right now.
No, I think you're right, because isn't there something in Shakespeare? I'm sure Shakespeare refers... He's always peppering Greek myths into his...
Yeah, that's a Latinized form of Greek Cerberos, which possibly meant spotted. There we go. Huh? Which I think is very funny, because you've got Hades, King of Hell, and he named his three-headed dog Spot.
Slightly better than Fluffy.
Oh, what are you talking about? This dog being called Spot. That's perfect. I had to start somewhere. So yeah, we've got, you know, the Hounds of Hell and Hellhounds, and it's all over the place. It's all over. And, you know, I wonder, what did dogs ever do that we decided they were going to be associated so much with death? And it maybe it's because you saw a lot of dogs around in grave sites, you know, in the same way that a lot of carrions and associated with death, dogs are too.
Well, you'd have seen wild dogs around for that sort of thing, and certainly during the time of the Black Death when bodies were left unburied.
Yeah.
And also around gibbets, and which were usually at crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason they're called gallows hounds as well, the black ghostly dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed to be the sort of hungry feral dogs that were trying to feed on dead people at gibbets.
Which is totally legit, to be honest. I mean,
yep.
If it's just hanging there, you might as well eat it. What? Talking from a totally practical point of view, if I was a hungry dog and I saw just a big piece of meat hanging from, you know, something, I'd probably want to eat it too. So that's my cannibalistic thought for the day. Moving on.
Yes, we're probably going to have to wrap it up very soon.
I like talking about big black dogs. I love the whole mythology of it. So let's do a quick review then. We've looked at the sort of the various versions of the big black dog that we get across Britain. And its similarities and some of the dissimilarities, both benevolent and malicious. And in particular, we've focused on how the big black dog, both psychologically and physically, is referred to and brought up in Jules's upcoming book, I Am the Silence, of which I will demand that she give details in a moment. And we've looked at it, sort of the black dog as a metaphor for depression, and its use in a little bit of its use in sort of music, and finally, its use in fiction in general, including in the Harry Potter and the Hound of the Baskervilles. So there we go. That's our big black dog. Jules, would you like to tell our listeners how and when they'll be able to get hold of I Am the Silence?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I Am the Silence is the second book in the Unveiled series. And it is out on the 19th, which is, well, from when this is aired, it'll be next Thursday. You can pre-order the ebook version on Amazon now, or you know, if you want a paperback version, it should come out on the day.
Very exciting.
So, yeah, mildly terrified.
Don't be terrified. It's a great book. It's better than the first one. I mean, I loved the first one, but the second one is just even better. It just blows it out of the water. It's fantastic.
And if you are interested at all in, you know, what Kieran has been up to in the meantime,
which I think by the time you start reading the second book, you'll be very interested in what the hell Kieran has been doing.
Then you can download a free copy of the novella from my website, which is www.jaironside.com. by joining my readers group. It's as simple as that. You can always leave the readers group whenever you want, and I won't take the book back.
You could try.
But yeah, it's a free sort of 40,000, 50,000 word novella. So, you know, not bad going. And I think it's probably the best one I've written of the three novellas that go in between.
I also cried again. Actually, I need to stop crying. I think I just from the moment I pick up after your work, I begin tearing up, and I don't stop until I've finished it. So
that's quite an advertisement.
So definitely worth checking out. Join the readers group, and yeah, look forward to I Am the Silence coming out on the 19th of January. And on that note, we will say goodbye, and we will catch you up next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.